This is the Afternoon Magazine on AM 580 WILL Urbana. Good afternoon. I'm Celeste Quinn. Writer Tracy Kidder is our guest this afternoon in this portion of the program. He joins us to tell us the story of a man who would cure the world, Dr. Paul Farmer. He is, at 43 years of age, a world-renowned expert in public health who has built a model healthcare organization, Partners in Health, that helps people in some of the poorest places in the world. Farmer is at the heart of Tracy Kidder's new book, Mountains Beyond Mountains, The Quest of Dr. Paul Farmer, A Man Who Would Cure the World. Listeners, I invite your questions and comments for Tracy Kidder this afternoon. You can join us with a telephone call in the Champaign-Urbana area. The number is 333-9455. That's 333-WILL. Outside the local dialing area, call toll-free 800-222-9455. 800-222-WILL. Now, let me tell you a little bit more about Paul Farmer and Tracy Kidder. Dr. Farmer is a full professor at Harvard Medical School and chairman of the Division of Social Medicine at the Brigham and Women's Hospital in Boston. His medical care organization has helped change the way the medical world approaches the treatment of multidrug-resistant tuberculosis and AIDS. He is a medical anthropologist and infectious disease specialist and the author of three books, the editor of two. Our guest this afternoon, Tracy Kidder, is a winner of the Pulitzer Prize, the National Book Award, and other literary prizes. His previous books are Hometown, Old Friends, Among School Children, House, and The Soul of a New Machine. His latest book, Mountains Beyond Mountains, is published by Random House. 333-9455, 800-222-9455. Tracy Kidder, thanks so much for joining us this afternoon.
My pleasure.
Tell us, first of all, about the Haitian proverb that inspired the title of the book.
The proverb says, beyond mountains, there are mountains. It's usually used in one of two ways, which are not inconsistent. Either means that there is no end to obstacles, or there's no end to opportunities. And I sort of see them fused. At least that was my idea in the title of this book, because I felt that it expressed something of the complexity and the scale, the sheer difficulty of farmer's work, but also something about the exhilaration of it.
At one point, you're walking with him in Haiti, and this is a long, strenuous walk. And you talk about what he calls the long defeat.
Yes.
Fighting the long defeat. What was he talking about?
Well, the background to this is that from time to time, it's complicated. let me back up for a second.
Sure.
When he was a very young man, before he even started medical school, he discovered this impoverished little corner of Haiti, which is, of course, the poorest country in the Western Hemisphere. And he started to build a healthcare system there, which is now being expanded to cover about an eighth of Haiti. It's a place where all the care is first rate and all of it is free. His dream for this place was to bring Boston medicine to this piece of this impoverished part of Haiti, and he's actually gone some distance toward doing that. On occasion, he's had patients who couldn't be treated there, and he had brought one back, or some of the people working with him in Partners in Health had brought back a boy who had a very rare form of cancer to the Mass General Hospital, which had agreed to give him free care because the cancer was so rare. Unfortunately, I mean, it was quite a travail getting the boy out of the country, and sadly, he died at Mass General. It was really too late. I'd gone along for this extraction of the boy, and I, in my darkest moments during that rather painful excursion, I had wondered, what was the point? They'd ended up having to use a medevac, and it cost Partners in Health $20,000. And I subsequently had spoken to a brand new member of Partners in Health who had sort of said, "Oh, gee, I just think how much we could have done with $20,000." So I decided to put that question to Farmer, and he basically said, "Look, the reason we took this boy to Boston is that his mother brought her to our hospital, and we felt duty bound to do everything we could for him, and we thought we had every reason to think that he had a fighting chance to survive." But then he went on and he said, there's so many ways to say, how, oh, gee, there's, I think of how much we could do with $20,000. He said, how about the airplane company? How come they didn't pay the fare? How about a doctor's salary? Young doctors make $100,000, $125,000 when they're still in, when they're just out of school. And how about that? It was really kind of interesting. And then he said, how about if I said this, that I fought all my life a long defeat? And he said, and I'm not, what we're doing, he said, is making common cause with the losers, with the people who are always getting shafted. And we're not going to quit just because we go on losing. And then he said, look, I mean, sometimes I actually wonder if we may not win. He said, we're not against defeat. We're not masochists. But what I think he was trying to say is that you have to be prepared to lose and to still go on fighting. I don't know that I can give you a better précis of it than that.
Yeah. Also, in this section of the book, you talk about his sense of triage.
Yes. Well, triage is an interesting word. It comes from old French word, which is applied to sorting wool according to its quality, to pick or to cull. And it has two nearly opposite meanings nowadays. In the battlefield situation, it means treating the people first who are gravely wounded but can be cured, and letting the others die. In an emergency room in America, in a good one, it doesn't mean withholding care from anyone. It actually means figuring out who is in gravest danger at the moment and giving that person priority. And I think that Haiti, the second kind of triage is the kind that farmers tried to apply to his work in Haiti and Peru and Russia and elsewhere. But Haiti, there's a kind of, Haiti is more like a place at war than a place at peace, even though without shots being fired. I mean, there's this kind of low-level, low-intensity warfare that just keeps killing people, kids, killing measles killing kids, tetanus killing kids, tuberculosis and AIDS killing adults, dirty water killing everybody. Part of the question, my question to him was, all your life you've had to face the, saying, I have to do this instead of that. And he said, yes, all the time. That's mm-hmm. all I do is decide not to do things. but I must say, the number of things that he continues to add on and to be able to do have been growing, and especially lately.
Yeah. And all that he has done, he calls a drop in the bucket.
Well, it is in a sense. Here's the secret, I think. He and his colleagues and partners in health have always taken the greatest pains with whatever project they've undertaken with individual patients. And paradoxically, I think that's how you get to have an effect on a large number of patients. You don't mess up. You don't get sloppy. But just to give you an example of the way influence can spread, the way these small gestures can add up, a couple of years ago, by 2001, he had about 125 patients in treatment for AIDS in this part of Haiti. That isn't a very large number, although I think it was the only program at the time that was treating desperately poor people in a desperately poor country, certainly in the rural part of a desperately poor country, and doing it with expertly and for free. But, 125 patients, we have somewhere between 40 and 60 million people in the world now who are infected with HIV. It seemed like a drop in the bucket. And yet, when he wrote about this program in the British medical journal, The Lancet, I saw the emails that came in. They came in from ministries of health all over the world, particularly from Africa, but also from Asia and elsewhere, and from all sorts of international health experts and even some former students of his who were involved in trying to get an AIDS treatment program going elsewhere. I mean, what it suddenly was a proof to the world that, yes, this was possible, because back then there were still a lot of arguments. Another way to say this is that, if you could show that you can treat AIDS effectively in a place like the Central Plateau of Haiti, if you can show that you can treat the whole range of human illnesses in a place like that, which is what he's done, then you've wiped away the arguments that I think have been developed in the Western world in order to make people like me feel better. Arguments such as you really can't do AIDS treatments in Africa because people don't have wristwatches there. That was one we heard a while ago. there are truly horrifying, enormous epidemics in the world today, particularly AIDS, tuberculosis, malaria. And here's a person who has shown us that there's no excuse for not taking them on and trying to stop them. You know, in a way, it's a tremendously hopeful message, and it's also rather daunting.
Yeah. Would you tell us the story Farmer likes to tell about his own education in Haiti, a story about the relationship between medicine and beliefs in sorcery?
Yeah, my favorite story.
Yeah.
I guess my favorite of all. You know, a lot of people, a lot of professionals in this kind of work believe that local beliefs, particularly, say, the belief in Haitian belief in sorcery, that kind of belief, is a tremendous impediment to Western medicine, to bringing modern medicine to a place. Here Farmer is as a young man. He lost some patients to tuberculosis who shouldn't have died, and he called the staff of this of Partners in Health in Haiti together, all Haitian staff, by the way. And they had an argument about why this, what was wrong with their TB program. And the professionals on the staff, the doctors and nurses and so on, all said that it was because the patients believed that TB came from sorcery, not from germs. And so they stopped taking their pills long before they were cured. And the community health workers, who are sort of the crucial part of this operation, are come from the peasantry. And they said, that's not true. That's not true. It's the poor who do worst in TB treatment, because they suffer from malnutrition, they don't have money to come to their doctor's appointments and so on. So Farmer decided to design a study, and he took I think there were 100 people in all, and 50 in each group. One group got first-rate TB care, the same they would have gotten in Boston, but nothing else. And the other group got that TB care, but they also got visits, regular visits from community health workers to make sure they took all their medicines, and also small monthly stipends that amounted to about $5 US a month for extra nutrition, for child care or transportation, you know, renting a donkey so that they could come to the health center to this medical complex for their monthly doctor's appointment. And he also went and interviewed all of these people about their beliefs in sorcery, and virtually everyone in both groups said that, yes, they believed TB came from sorcery. But when a year had passed, roughly a year, the cure rates were astonishingly different. The group that had gotten only medicine, out of that group only 48% were cured. Out of the group that had gotten the little extra monthly stipend, 100% had been cured. And whether or not they believed TB came from sorcery didn't seem to have mattered at all. So he was really puzzled about this. He was an anthropologist in training. He was still a student at Harvard and a resident at the Brigham and Women's Hospital. So he went back and re-interviewed all of the peasants, all of the patients, who all happened to be peasants. And he came to a rather elderly woman who he really liked. And when he had first interviewed her a year before, she'd said, "No, she wasn't a hick. She knew that TB came from germs." But this time when he re-interviewed her, she said, of course she believed in sorcery, and she said to him, "I know who sent me my TB, and I'm going to get her back." At which point, Farmer, in consternation, just said, "Then if you believe that, then why'd you take your medicines?" And he remembered this look that she gave him, like the look of an elder trying to explain something elementary to a child, and she said, "Honey, are you incapable of complexity?" And at that point, of course, he realized that, you know, Haitian peasants, you can believe in sorcery and you can also believe in medicine. After all, he, like many Americans, he himself believes both in the power of medicine and prayer. Mm. And, you know, and from then on in, he said, okay, everybody's getting this full range of services. I'm not going to worry about my patients' beliefs in sorcery so much. I'm just going to worry about their material circumstances. And the TB program that he developed, which relies heavily on these community health workers, has not lost a single patient since 1988. They have had a 100% cure rate of people in their catchment area who had only ordinary tuberculosis, which is really quite astonishing. And then they just simply took AIDS treatment. Once they started to get the money for it and once the cost of those drugs started to come down, they simply laid that on top of the program that had come out of this little study.
Is he a religious man?
Yes, I think he is. He grew up Catholic. he wasn't much taken with Catholicism as a boy, but as he working in Haiti, he first of all noticed that almost all of his patients were very religious. It's often said of Haiti, I don't know how true it is anymore, that it's 90% Catholic and 100% voodoo, but they were very religious, and it made him feel that religion then must be something good, something valuable. And then as time went on, the way he told it to me was he started to feel that he had the need of some religious belief himself, that someone, maybe someone omniscient, had to be watching this horror show, is the way he said. Mm. You know, someone had to be keeping score. The branch of Catholicism that he finds most attractive is called liberation theology, which has been pretty much squashed by the current pope. It grew out of Latin America, and it has its central tenet is that one should provide a preferential option for the poor, that somehow that the Gospels command this. But there are limits to all this. Farmer once said to me of liberation theology, it's an ology after all, and all ologies fail us at some point.
Hmm. It seems to me his training in anthropology has been really important for him.
Yes.
Yeah.
I think that's true. I mean, first of all, his training in anthropology included learning the language, the local language, and he speaks it like a rat, as the Haitians say. That's a compliment. he speaks perfectly fluent Creole, beautiful Creole, and writes it too. In addition, I think it's that, more than anything, it's that attitude of openness towards, another society that one hopes anthropology cultivates, that has been tremendously important to him. I mean, a person who came in, with big heavy boots, so to speak, you know, might end up at war with, say, a voodoo priest. But Farmer's case, I mean, these guys are his allies. In fact, I think a couple dozen of them who were actually his patients, and they work as virtually as community health workers for him, bringing in patients. You know, I think you'd be very puzzled and maybe even apt to be scornful of some of the what seemed to us like very strange beliefs that people in the Haitian countryside have. But I think, you know, an anthropologist's demeanor, his attitude, you know, prevents that. And I think it also allowed him to find, I mean, one of the problems with a lot of aid, you know, even well-meant aid projects to places such as Haiti is that they rarely sort of take the local people into account, you know. You want to build a road and keep it maintained. You tend not to think about the way in which Haitians might view road maintenance, you know, and try to make things fit. I think Farmer's always taken pains to try to figure out what it was that the people he was trying to serve wanted most and needed most. You know, and sometimes you can't know what you need because you've never had any of it, you know, like clean water. Although they sure know they need water.
Yeah.
They haven't always known that they needed clean water, but the minute he cleaned up the water supplies, which is one of the very first things he and his colleagues did in this desolate part of Haiti, you know, everyone began to see how wonderful that was because children stopped dying in droves.
This approach, it seems to me, could go a long way to help alleviate suffering among people of any class.
I think that's absolutely true. You know, one of the really interesting things about this it started with this TB program, and I mean, it's become the sort of center of all of their efforts, the efforts that Partners in Health has made in Peru and is making in Russia now, and it's this community-based medicine. And what I love is recently they have an AIDS project in Boston in a poor neighborhood that's right near the Brigham and Women's Hospital, serving people for whom AIDS treatment was just failing, poor people. And what they did was to take the system that they'd developed in Haiti and bring it to Boston, where it's working very well indeed. And it's which is a wonderful technology transfer in medicine, you can imagine, from Haiti, where there is none, to Boston, where there's so much.
Yeah.
The beauty of this system of community health workers, part of the beauty of it is that it's very inexpensive compared to hospitalization, for instance. Farmer cures an ordinary case of tuberculosis, an uncomplicated case of tuberculosis, for less than $200 in Haiti. In the United States, the same cure usually costs about $20,000, largely because it usually involves hospitalization.
Yeah.
But anyway, I mean, he's pretty convinced that community-based medicine would work wonderfully well in a lot of the, you know, really troubled inner cities of the United States.
Yeah. There's an anecdote in the book about a patient he sees in Boston who has AIDS. I can't remember if his name is John
Joe. Well, no, I changed his name. Yeah.
But this says two things, I think. Not only does it say he has tremendous rapport with people, his patients.
Yeah.
But it also gets at this idea of, let's figure out what we can do to make this guy's life better, and
Right. Let's
add it up.
Right.
And take our losses where we're going to have our losses.
Yeah.
And take our wins where we're going to have our wins.
Right. Well, this poor guy was, you know, living under bridges. He was a drug addict. Just about every drug you can think of. A very nice guy, and an alcoholic, too, I guess. And, you know, Farmer very quickly diagnosed the condition he was brought in to diagnose. But, you know, I mean, he has a way around patients. It's really quite amazing. It's sort of magical. And he gets his hands on them very quickly. Sometimes I remember feeling in that case that he was just about to climb in bed with the guy. He didn't, of course. But he's very tender with his patients. And he started talking with the guy, and the guy just opened up to him. And at some point he said, Farmer said, well, what can we do for you? And he said, well, if I could go to a shelter, you know, where I maybe could have a drink once in a while, you know, that would be good. Farmer said, well, that sounds reasonable to me. I'll see what I can do. But, of course, you can't. And you know, obviously, if you're trying to run a shelter, you can't have people drinking in them, I suppose. But he got into a lively debate on the blackboard outside the social worker's office in Brigham. I think on one side he'd put in and out, meaning for the patient. And on one side he had half gallon of vodka. No, on one side, that meaning outside, living under the bridge, their drugs, and on in our drugs, out half gallon of vodka, in six pack of beer, you know, out freezing to death, in you know, warm and so on, you know. So, I think that's a story you had in mind.
Yeah, it is. It is.
I found it. I mean, that's the way he is. He doesn't, he grew up in such an unconventional way. I think that's probably helped him, at least initially, not to see the world in conventional terms or the solutions to problems in conventional terms. And it's been very useful.
Yeah, I'm going to ask you about that in just a moment.
Sure.
Let me reintroduce you and what we're talking about today. And I think we've got a listener calling in, so we'll take a call as well. Tracy Kidder is our guest this afternoon here on the Afternoon Magazine. He's a writer, a reporter. He is the author of the new book, Mountains Beyond Mountains, The Quest of Dr. Paul Farmer, A Man Who Would Cure the World. Paul Farmer is a world-renowned expert in public health who has built a model healthcare organization called Partners in Health that helps people in some of the poorest places in the world. Listeners, you can join us with your questions and comments this afternoon. Give us a telephone call. The number in the Champaign-Urbana area, 333-9455. That's 333-WILL. Anywhere else, toll free, 800-222-9455, 800-222-WILL. Well, Tracy Kidder, tell us how Paul Farmer grew up. What was his childhood like?
He grew up on a bus with his five brothers and sisters and his mother and father. And then his father, who was a pretty interesting, eccentric guy, decided to move the whole family onto a 50-foot-long, half-homemade, leaky old boat, which was moored in a bayou in Florida on the Gulf Coast. You know, they had no running water and tiny little refrigerator, that sort of thing. He went on. I once said to his mother, no couch potatoes in your family, and she said, no couch. He was a brainy kid, and he went to Duke on a full scholarship and then to Harvard, where he got degrees in both in medical anthropology, PhD in medical anthropology, and his MD simultaneously, but he wasn't often there. That's a sort of the amazing thing. You know, he was mostly in Haiti, where he was doing his studying for Harvard. He still graduated at the top of his medical school class. So, you know, a person of that sort of He's a person of enormous talent, so I'm sure there are other people of equal ones around. What's really interesting about him is the way he's applied them. I mean, he keeps nothing for himself. The guy doesn't sleep much, which isn't a good thing, but he doesn't. And he seems to have, and he's really genuine. I mean, he's really for real. You know, I'm schooled in skepticism over the years, and there are no dirty secrets about this fellow. He is just what he appears to be. Hmm. Even he makes altruism seem plausible and effective. That's the other thing, is that, you know, it isn't just talk. It wouldn't be interesting if it were just talk. This is he and his colleagues, I mean, really are serving hundreds of thousands, maybe millions of people now. And they have managed to change a lot of attitudes about not just particular diseases, but I think at least they're beginning to change attitudes about whether or not these terrible health problems that are assailing the world are, in fact, soluble. I mean, he insists that they are, both on moral grounds, but also on practical ones.
Yeah. He's not only is he a doctor and an educator, he's had to be a fundraiser.
Yeah.
And that, for, you know...
Well, he's been lucky.
Yeah.
I mean, in some ways, but he's also charming. I mean, you expect a person like this to be really dour, or, you know, at best, very severe. And in fact, he's very funny. I had great fun traveling with him. It was really one of the most exhilarating things I've ever done. It was hard for me because I don't travel so well, but it was just exhilarating and often very funny. And the other thing about him is when you get sick, he takes care of you. My favorite memory of that is being on a plane with him, where I was sick. I had diarrhea, and I wasn't going to tell him. And right until the moment when I did, and he had just about fallen asleep. He woke right up and he looked at me very seriously and said, "From now on, I want a full report on all of your bowel movements." I thought, you know, funny. I'd seen this guy bring people virtually back from the dead, and I thought better already. You know.
Yeah. Let's go back to the very opening of Mountains Beyond Mountains. Mm-hmm. This is the first line. 6 years after the fact, Dr. Paul Edward Farmer reminded me, we met because of a beheading, of all things. You met in 1994. Tell us about that first meeting.
Well, I had gone to Haiti. If you recall that in 1994, the United States sent quite a large expeditionary force to restore the democratically elected government of Haiti, which had been deposed by a military junta which had ruled the country with unbelievable cruelty for about 3 years, basically a terrorist organization. I was hanging out with these soldiers in the town in the Central Plateau. Things had quieted down quite a bit, but there had been a horrible political murder, and an assistant mayor had been beheaded, presumably by the by a former functionary of the military junta. The soldiers had released the guy. They had arrested him and released him because they couldn't find any witnesses against him. And Farmer had come to talk to the American commander's young captain. And they ended up having quite a lively little argument, which was fascinating to me. Although I didn't much like Farmer at the moment, because it seemed to me that he might be one of those people who reflexively disliked soldiers. And having been a soldier myself, I a little sensitive about that. But then I ran into him on the airplane going back to Miami that Christmas, and I found out that wasn't true, that he didn't reflexively dislike much of anybody on Earth. And also I began to get the sense of the outlines of his life. And I saw him again not long after that. I took him to dinner in Boston, and I was, you know, learning more and more about what he'd done. You know, here was a guy who could be on his way to living a very posh life, who seemed to be, you know, sacrificing everything that people like me sort of think is important for the sake of this cause, you know. But I didn't pursue him. I didn't pursue him for another 5 years, and ordinarily I would have. But I think, you know, Haiti really upset me when I first saw it. I'd been to Vietnam as a soldier, but I'd never seen anything quite as awful as Haiti. In 1994, I guess it's the sight of children starving and things like that. But it really upset me, and I was struggling to find a way to reconcile the fact of Haiti with my privileged life. You know, basically struggling with a way to hang on to the notion that my my happy life was the result of, you know, was something I had earned, you know. And I knew, I think, deep down that if I started hanging around with Paul Farmer, he was going to disturb my peace of mind. Mm. That was quite true, although in quite a wonderful way. Mm. You know, not in a way, I mean, the point about him is not to feel bad because you don't do as much as he does. I suppose he does make some people feel that way, but I don't think he wants to. The point is to realize that I think the moral of the story is that individuals can make a difference. And, you know, and he doesn't ask that people be like him. He doesn't expect anyone to be like him, but he does want people to recognize that these terrible calamities that are going on in the world, and especially Americans, and to do at least a little something, mm-hmm. you know. And maybe I could just go back to the business of fundraising, because there's something I'd really like to, a story I'd love to tell, which is about this guy, Tom White, who was, Tom White was had taken over his father's moribund construction company and built it into one of the largest in Boston. He's a very wealthy man, a rather shy man, and he'd been giving money away for years, even before he had much. And he met Farmer, and that's kind of a lovely story, but in any case, he started giving Paul the money to do all of these things in Haiti initially, lifting death sentences off of thousands, hundreds of thousands. God knows how many people now. Tom White, not too long ago, he's in his 80s now, he told me that he wanted to leave this life without a nickel, and he's doing a very good job. He's just about done it. But I mean, I don't know how to count how many millions he's given away, but it's millions and millions and millions of dollars. And he also financed their project in Peru, which is, I think, really crucial story. But yeah. I don't know if we have time for that.
Yeah. Let's talk with a listener who's waiting for us on line one in Urbana. Good afternoon.
Yes, I wanted to thank you for having Mr. Kidder on and thank Mr. Kidder for his book. I just finished it in the last few days and was quite inspired. I've read most of your other works, and when this one came out, I knew I wanted to read it just because you had written it. I didn't have any idea what the topic was, and once I got into Dr. Farmer's story, I was just intrigued and amazed. So I appreciate your incredible storytelling ability. The thing that was different about this from your other ones, obviously, is that you were very much a character in it. And yeah. So I wanted to ask you, you started just a few minutes ago talking about how your collaboration began with Dr. Farmer, but if you could tell a little more of that story. It seems like it would be difficult logistically to find out what you needed to find out, and I would suspect that he would have had a lot of reservations about it. So could you talk more about that?
Yeah, sure. It's not so much a collaboration. I think it's a victimization. You know, that's what we writers do. But he consented to let me follow him around, first of all, for a month. I think he was reluctant because I don't think he wanted much attention brought to himself. He did want attention brought to his cause and to his organization. I mean, Partners in Health now has more than 1,000 people working for it. You know, most of them, most I'd say, are community health workers, peasants, or in Haiti. But they also include a lot of young doctors at the Brigham, and you know, a myriad other people, and lots of fellow travelers. And he just, I think, felt. And I think he still does. He feels ambivalent about it, that he's being sort of singled out. But it seemed to me the only way I could really write the book and make it engaging. But having allowed me to go along with him, he allowed me to see everything. And when he had time, he talked to me a great deal. I took copious notes and used a tape recorder sometimes on some of these hikes when my notebook was wet with sweat. He doesn't mind saying what he thinks, you know. So it was worked out pretty well. The reason I felt that I had to write in the first person was twofold. First of all, this is an improbable person, and I thought the reader would need an everyman, a character there who is a lot less virtuous than Farmer, to testify to the fact that this guy is for real. but also, and maybe more important, to acknowledge the discomfort that anyone is apt to feel in the presence of a person like this. It's, you know, at times, not certainly not always, but from time to time. So, have I answered your question?
Yes, thank you.
You're welcome. Thank you.
Thanks for the call this afternoon. Other calls are invited. Questions, comments, 333-9455, the number in the Champaign-Urbana area. Anywhere else, toll-free, 800-222-9455. Tracy Kidder, our guest this afternoon here on the Afternoon Magazine. His latest book, Mountains Beyond Mountains, The Quest of Dr. Paul Farmer, A Man Who Would Cure the World. I imagine Paul Farmer seeing this book as a way to get the word out to more people, as a way to reach an audience he couldn't otherwise.
I think that's right. I think that's the only reason he consented to let me hang around.
Yeah, because in addition to Partners in Health, there is a research and education arm of this organization, which is called the Institute for Health and Social Justice.
Yep, which he founded with the grant. You know, he got one of those MacArthur Genius Awards and immediately turned all the money over to Partners in Health to create that research branch.
Yeah.
But, you know, he said, somebody asked him not long ago if he had to think hard about giving all that money away, and he said no. He said, I mean, I was given the grant because I had written about poor people and had worked among poor people. It would have been obscene for me to keep that money.
Yeah. Does he have a personal life?
Sure. He has quite a lovely personal life. It's all bound up with his work. He has a wife and a young daughter, and he sees them whenever he possibly can, not as often as he'd like, and less often than some people around him think that he should. But and some people, you know, I think sort of think, saying, "Aha, here's a chink in his moral armor. He doesn't spend enough time with his family." You know, do make something of an issue of it. Although, to me, it ought to be just a reason for feeling sympathetic. I mean, you know, he's torn.
No.
But he does have, and he's a tremendously gregarious, sociable person. So and no one could doubt that he dotes on his wife and his daughter and misses them all the time. He calls them every day, no matter where he is. Mm. Sometimes it's pretty tough.
Mm. You know, in I can hear in your voice, I can hear your passion about this man and what he's doing in the world.
Yeah, I mean, it's not just him, too. I should say, you know, there are these wonderful people around him.
Mm-hmm.
Jim Young Kim, who just got a MacArthur Grant, who's been his sidekick for years, who's now the senior advisor to the new director general of the World Health Organization, Jim Young Kim, and Ophelia Dahl, who is the daughter of the writer Raoul Dahl and the actress Patricia Neal. She went to Haiti when she was 18, and Paul met Paul there. He was 23, and they fell in love. It's a kind of a lovely story. It didn't end in marriage, but lifelong friendship. She still runs Partners in Health, really. She's the central glue, a very funny, judicious, and calm woman. I mean, just lovely.
Yeah. What is required of the people that work with him, for him?
Oh, boy. Well, lots and lots of work. And
yeah.
I mean, the young doctors sign up. It's amazing. I mean, they sign up to work in some of the most dreadful places you can imagine. I mean, you know, the shanty town outside of Lima where they started this amazing project to cure a supposedly incurable TB and in Haiti. It requires a fair amount of sacrifice for the people who are actually on the ground, you know. And he does demand a lot from the people who are working with him. And I suppose the more important you are to the work, the more he demands.
Yeah.
But he's extremely, you know, but he forgives everybody if for everything. One of I think Jim Kim once said, "I don't want you to meet Jesse Helms, and I think I'm afraid you'd end up liking him."
He's a tireless guy, Paul Farmer.
Yeah, he's a tireless guy, and the organization. I mean, the organization is now bigger than him, you know, and I think that's kind of wonderful. I mean, he doesn't always have to be in Haiti for the work to continue there, and he doesn't always have to be in Peru for the work to continue there. I sort of hope, given that I think he's a really valuable person to the world, and personally think he's like him a great deal. I sort of hope that he can rest a little more often.
Yeah.
I don't know if he will or not, but
Is he still making these incredible house calls?
Yeah, but those are, well, not at the moment. He has, he's temporarily disabled he had an operation on his knee, a major surgery. But those are terribly important to him. To be able, and people criticize him for that, actually, that, you know, a guy of his stature should actually spend, you know, 10 hours hiking through the Haitian countryside to visit two families of patients. But, you know, I think there are a couple of things. I mean, he would say, you know, the idea that some lives matter more than others is what's the root of all that's wrong with the world, and these people are as important as anyone, A. But also, I think he's a doctor, all doctor, right from the ground up. That's the thing that he really loves to be. And making those house calls, seeing these people living in their dreadful medieval huts, I think, you know, renews his passion and his authority. And it's what allows him to climb on airplanes. You know, he's nauseated every flight he takes to climb on airplanes and fly, I don't know, 250,000 miles a year and scheme about the big picture, you know, the health of populations and so on.
Yeah. Well, he tells you at one point, it is through journeys to the sick that we identify needs and problems.
Yes.
And I think also we have to wrap up pretty quickly here. But it also, by identifying needs and problems, we can begin to undo what he calls structural violence in healthcare.
Yeah, I think that's right. I think what he would say, and I'm not to the extent that I could speak for him in this, is that illness is the result. I mean, great burdens of illness are the result of poverty generally. So he's dealing with the very sort of far end result of a much bigger and more difficult problem. But that's not to say that you couldn't begin to tackle that problem starting with health. After all, what's more fundamental? Mm-hmm. You know, what's more important? And I think that the aphorism that somebody coined not so long ago is to say that people are sick because they're poor, but they're also poor because they're sick is to a large degree true. Certainly, great burdens of illness destroy economies.
Yeah.
And, you know, beginning to address this problem can help to revive an economy, perhaps. But in any case, it's the right thing to do.
Yeah.
I'm sure of that.
Yeah. This project, this reporting project, Mountains
Yes.
Beyond Mountains, and getting to know and being so affected by Paul Farmer, do you think it will affect what you look at from here down the line as to what reporting projects you'll do?
Well, I have another project that I'm signed up to do, which is very different. It's a memoir about the year I spent in Vietnam as a soldier.
Mm.
But yeah, I think it will affect it. I don't intend to leave this behind. I do feel as though I would like to contribute in one way or another for the rest of my life. Whether, you know, I'm not quite sure whether that means more writing about these people or on, you know, just what subjects. But I'm still. I'm afraid that other subjects will seem too unimportant after this, but I'm sure that you know I will want to do some slightly different things.
We have one listener waiting to talk with us, and so we'll have to make it quick. But I do want to get to the caller, listener on a cell phone, line one. Go ahead.
Thank you. I was just wondering if in summary, maybe three principles or tenets that could be applied to our, you know, to medicine here in the United States from what he's learned there. I mean, what can we learn from this process?
Well, I think, I do think that in the narrow sense, the community-based medicine is something we really ought to look hard at, and I'm sure some places are. I think we have to look at costs in this country and the real, and what's driving them. But most of all, what I think Farmer would say is, this is just criminal that the richest country in the world, the country that spends more per capita on health than any other nation on earth, should have 44 million people uninsured and many people who are theoretically are insured unhappy with their medical care. It's time for really a great overhaul. But I'm not an expert on these things, and I'm stepping off into deep water here already. I would like to say one thing that, I mean, if people are interested in knowing more about this organization and so on, besides reading my book, they could go to pih.org on the web.
Yeah, Partners in Health, pih.org.
Right.
Tracy Kidder, thank you so much for talking with us this afternoon.
Thanks for having me on. I enjoyed it.
My pleasure. Tracy Kidder has been our guest in this portion of the Afternoon Magazine. His latest book, Mountains Beyond Mountains, The Quest of Dr. Paul Farmer, A Man Who Would Cure the World. The book is published by Random House.